Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Hey, Breaking Banks, are you looking forward to next year? I can tell you I am ready to be done with this one. As we approach the end of a very disruptive and chaotic year, let's talk about what 2021 might hold for financial services, fintech, and venture capital. On this episode, we're speaking to Debbie Bianucci, President and Chief Executive Officer of BAI, to hear her thoughts on the last 11 months and predictions for the new year. And in the second segment, I'm joined by Sheila Manat and Jake Gibson of Better Tomorrow Ventures to discuss BTV's $75 million raise and how they're having a positive impact and helping the world of entrepreneurs really create a better tomorrow. Then stay tuned for a quick update as Brett King hosts Charles Green, founder and CEO of RFI Group, to hear about a recent strategic growth investment RFI Group received from Diversus Capital Partners that will allow RFI to expand their footprint and data services. So Debbie, for those who might not be as familiar with BAI, can you share a little bit about your mission and who your constituents are?
Sure. We're a leading industry organization. We don't do any lobbying. Our purpose is to support financial services leaders as they run their business. And we work with banks, credit unions, mortgage companies, fintechs, all different kinds of financial services companies to help them make better decisions about their business with research, education, and various kinds of thought leadership.
So, you know, it obviously has been a pretty interesting year. And I'm guessing a lot of these organizations have leaned heavily on you. What are your observations, you know, when historians write the history or do the study of 2020? What do you think it meant for financial services?
Well, it certainly was a year of disruption. And, you know, Jason, it was one that was unlike anything I've seen in my career. And I mean that in a good way, because what happened with the banks is they were thrust into the situation like we all were, but they moved faster, they made bolder decisions, and they delivered for their colleagues and their customers in ways that no one ever thought was possible in the toughest of circumstances. And what I think that means for them is that they have learned what can happen to be more nimble and to move faster. And the disruption that they experienced, even though it was thrust upon them, is going to forever change the way that the industry works. I mean, I'll give you an example, because the PPP loans that were handled all by the banks did over 5 million loans in 4 months.
Yep.
When the SBA did about 70,000 in all of 2019. And so it demonstrates what the banks can do if they think differently about how to approach their business. And if you think about digital adoption, the way in which consumers have changed the way they want to interact with the banks had to figure that out quickly. And it worked. So I think it's the industry is forever changed, but in a much better way.
Yeah, it really did change from the we can't to the we must. And a lot of those naysayers, I think, within the organization, you know, couldn't use the political power of, you know, but this is the way we've always done it, or, oh, those tech companies can do that, but we could never do that. The incumbents really did, you know, break down a lot of that scar tissue.
Well, it's a little bit of, you know, be careful what you pray for, because the banks have for a long time planned and wanted to have their customers change the way they interacted, not so dependent upon the branch, using the digital channels. And then suddenly it happened. And I think the way you described it is accurate in a way that the banks were much more action-oriented and willing to take some more risks in part because they were motivated to keep their customers and colleagues safe, but make sure that they could get their banking done.
Yes. Were there any changes that you expected that you didn't see more of?
That's a great question, because I think the changes that occurred as the banks were evolving from, if you think about going back to early March to mid-March, and then through each month as we went through the pandemic and the period of social unrest that began maybe in the April-May timeframe, the banks' challenges were changing during those times. But probably what I thought we would see more of is a sustained change in the way in which the branch delivery and contact center delivery were initially changed, and that they would have gone on for longer. But it was really interesting to see how the challenges they faced changed almost week to week. So as soon as they thought and figured something out, then the next week it was a new challenge they had to figure out, which was part of what perpetuated this agile, bold, more flexible decision-making that really made a difference in the pandemic.
Call it the series of waves that, you know, came mm-hmm. at them, you know, like a set, not just a single wave. I think that's an important aspect to what really moved them, because you can't say, oh, I'm going to be the fast follower. I'm going to wait and see how this plays out, right, and then I'll respond. You know, which is, let's face it, for a lot of incumbent financial institutions, that's what they do. But that insight you just had around, if you waited, you know, now you're just stacking up challenge upon challenge, you know, so you have to be in the moment with the decision making.
Well, that's absolutely true. And one of the things that we found, and one of the things that we do at BAI, is to help facilitate the collaboration across the banks and the industry, which when COVID hit, there had to be fast connections made so that the banks could compare notes. And Jason, all the secret sauce went out the window, because there's nothing in a competitive advantage to try and figure out how to keep your employees safe, for example.
Yep.
And so we found that the collaboration and the ability to compare notes on the questions they were facing and the alternatives that they were considering really helped them, because they could make better decisions in the context of knowing what the other banks were doing.
Now, do you think this is going to change decision-making structures organizationally? Are you seeing changes made within the bank or the insurance company or the credit union?
Well, you know, it's really hard to generalize on that, because there are so many different organizational structures. But if you had to pick one thing that probably is changed, is the courage associated with doing things faster and trying things and managing them in a more real-time basis. So you try something, it doesn't work, you evolve it, and that's what Agile's all about. And so while I don't know that you could generalize about the way structures might change or decision processes might change, what is changing is it'll happen faster. And that's good for customers, because the banks will be able to be more responsive. Banks, insurance companies, mortgage companies, et cetera.
So I know you guys just finished some research that was identifying the top three priorities and areas that financial service leaders have identified for 2021. Can you share with us, you know, what did they put up for their priorities? I'm very curious if they've shifted from past years.
Well, there have been some changes, but I would say that the overriding theme is that it's all about digital, digital, and digital. And so the priorities that have been set based on the research that BAI conducted show that the digital customer experience, the underlying technology that supports that digital experience, and the ability to build brand awareness and building the brand of the organizations in order to be seen as a digital player are the priorities that they're setting for the coming year. It's all about digital.
In all digital customer facing, or is it a lot of digital, you know, in the back office as well?
It's both. And it's not just consumers, it's also digital for business customers. I think what the banks, as they look at their plans for 21, also have to recognize is that with the pace of change, the importance of balancing a short-term view with a long-term view has never been more important. Because, for example, the competitive landscape is changing. The way in which consumers are evaluating how they want to work with different types of financial services companies is changing. And the banks really need to be on top of their game as it relates to that.
Now, I was reading one of your Forbes articles, and you had other BAI research that showed 82% of consumers prefer non-digital, though, when it comes to getting advice about complex processes or services, and 81% preferring human assistance for solving account problems. How do you see that merge between, you know, this push for digitization, the need for digitization, but one of the other things customers are also asking for is that human interaction?
Well, I think the pandemic has changed that even further than what we have known in the past couple of years of what this research measured. I mean, if you think about digital doctor's appointments now and how people, all of us, are more accepting of the kinds of technology tools that would not have been acceptable 9 months ago. But it isn't for everything, right? Not every doctor's appointment can be handled with a video call. And not every banking service can be handled with a any kind of a digital or video connection. And so what we're seeing is there's an increase in acceptance of more and more things that consumers and business customers will be willing to do, but there's still a need for some human interaction on certain types of things, depending on the segment of the consumer base that you're dealing with and the type of service that's being provided. So it's we just don't think it's going to be all one thing as time goes on. There will still be a need for human interaction.
Yeah. And, you know, as we're in this chronic phase of how we think of, you know, change, how do you think that's going to play out? Like, where will the role of that human interaction be, and how might that evolve as you're looking out, you know, beyond 2021?
Well, we know from the interaction that we have with the executives who are running the largest banks that they are seriously looking at trying to predict how their customers are going to want to be able to do business. Because as much as the financial services leaders have their preferences for what they'd like to be able to do, in the end, it's really all about the customer.
Yep.
And so understanding how these preferences will change is what is driving that. And what we can see, Jason, is that the customers who have adopted new channels and digital capabilities so quickly during the pandemic are telling us that they want to continue with that. And that's likely to increase, which is going to change the way that people are interacting with their financial services providers and which financial services providers they work with going forward. So we expect to see continued, even radical changes in the way in which these financial services will be delivered.
And I think, you know, part of that, we're seeing more and more encroachment by the large technology companies that are only extending that reach in digitization, you know, with Google entering the fray to be partnering with banks, with Stripe and, you know, beginning to work with Goldman Sachs, that it isn't just the digital drive internal to financial services. There's a digital drive, you know, coming from the side as well.
Well, and you know that from all the work that you've done and the leadership that you've had with the industry, how important these partnerships are. And in the beginning, it was not really viewed that way, but many of the major financial services companies and other technology firms have found great value in this collaboration and partnership. And yep. I think that'll continue.
Yeah. Now, you have such an interesting global view. Has the pandemic force change, in a more variable sense, depending on the region, or is the response, pretty similar region to region?
Well, we're about to evaluate our Global Innovation Awards that we do every year. And it's going to be very interesting this year to see what kind of an impact the pandemic had on innovation. What we're seeing so far is that there's actually more and different kinds of innovation, things that are affecting certainly the way COVID hit, but also the way that financial services companies are looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion and other important topics, not to mention digital transformation and product issues and so forth. I do think that the U.S. continues to lag Europe on important areas of evolution, including open banking. Yep. But that is likely to be equalized, I would expect, over the course of the next few years. So all regions were affected by the pandemic, but I do think we've responded differently based on the places from where we started.
Yeah. I mean, people in the United States might not be aware that, getting your taxes done in places like Germany, it's done by text message. And I think the average time that I saw was it's something less than a minute that the government actually tells you what you owe and you respond yes, no, and bank account information. So that you're certainly starting from a different place if that's what it takes to file your taxes. You certainly are going to be more accepting of doing things like online loan applications and pieces right. like that. Now, of the financial institutions that you survey and you talk to, where are they feeling the greatest disruption from their businesses? Is it the rise of the startups? Is it the tech companies? Is it the largest players within financial services being disruptive? But what's keeping them up at night?
I'd say yes, all of the above, for sure. I think as we go into 21, the pressure on expenses and profitability is just pervasive. And it's in part because of the continuation of the interest rate environment that we're in and the pressure that that puts on lenders of any kind. But one of the things that we are seeing is, and this goes back to the importance of balancing the short-term and long-term planning assumptions that financial services companies are making, is that the short-term pressure to cut costs is real. It's huge. But the need to invest in technology, talent, other types of innovation for the long haul is essential for survival. And so there's this balance that the banks have to play. And so I think we're going to see that in the short run, there are going to be potentially some radical expense reduction decisions that could have an impact on the long-term viability of some of these organizations.
That's interesting, because one of the things that was very clear from the Alloy Labs members, the panel of 45 plus banks we work with, is their recognition, and I think this might be what you're speaking about, is short-term expense reduction has long-term implications. Most are actually looking at foundational investments that previously, because they couldn't say, here's the hard ROI of doing, building an analytics capability or the focus on RPA or data availability, that now they're realizing, oh, wait a second, that was very short-sighted of us. Well, the ROI is hard to point to. It's like, here are the three drivers. If we don't do some of these things, we're dooming ourselves.
Well, it's absolutely true. And I think that's also leads to the question about industry consolidation and what is often predicted now, that there'll be a wave of mergers that will prepare the banks to have more size and scale to be able to make the kinds of investments that you're describing. And that's something that's going to forever change the face of the industry. This industry has gone through waves of consolidation in the past, but what's ahead of us is likely to be some of the most dramatic change that we've ever seen.
So wrapping up, if you're a financial service leader, you know, some of the leaders who come to you looking for advice, what are the top three factors you'd say as you're looking to 2021 and beyond? Here are those factors you need to keep top of mind.
Start with your customer and really understand to the best of your ability what your customer wants and lead with that. Pay attention to the competitive landscape because it's changing. And the way consumers and businesses are looking at your competitors, who are not just like you, there are many different kinds of financial services providers. There's more of a willingness to consider different types of companies. And third, balance your short-term pressures with your long-term investments so that you are able to meet whatever the expectations are in 21, but you are not setting yourself up to be greatly limited as you go into 22 and 23.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing the research and your perspectives on this, Debbie, and look forward to that next piece of research that is coming out on how the pandemic has impacted regions differently. If people want to subscribe to BAI research, where should they go?
BAI.org.
Fantastic. Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks, Jason. Great to see you.
Have things been a little bit chaotic for you lately? Well, you're not alone. 2020 was a year of uncertainty. And part of that means it can be so busy to even find the talent you need to get ahead, you just don't have time. That's why we use Fiverr, an online marketplace that connects businesses with freelancers offering hundreds of digital services, including graphic design, copywriting, web programming, film editing, and more. Why I like Fiverr? I can customize my search. We can find someone with the exact talents. We can see the reviews. We can see the work products that they've done for others. And we know we've got Fiverr standing behind us with 24/7 customer service. We use Fiverr all of the time to get highly tailored services doing exactly what we need. Check out Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R.com, and receive 10% off your first order by using my code BREAKING. Breaking as in breaking banks at Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R.com, and receive 10% off. Find all the digital services you need in one place using the code BREAKING. Again, Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R.com with the code BREAKING.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Well, thanks for taking time off because realize, you know, COVID might have the country locked down, but FinTech is certainly not locked down right now. And so congratulations first on raising the new fund. Shiel, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about BTV, which is the shorthand for Better Tomorrow Ventures. You know, what is the thesis that you're investing behind?
Sure. So quick background, we are a $60 million plus fund. We lead pre-seed and seed stage fintech companies, and we invest globally. And I say we, it's currently me and Jake. We are both founders in the fintech space or have been founders in the past and like to think of BTV as just another company that we're now building. And then in terms of where we invest, we take a pretty broad view on fintech. A lot of stuff that other people might not consider fintech, we do. For example, we think a lot of vertical SaaS and marketplace businesses will add in financial services layers over time. And we would invest in those companies as fintech companies and have done that in the past. And you know, we invest for a better future, hence the name. We think financial technology is a great way to improve people's lives. What else can I tell you? We're based in the Bay Area, but we really believe that there's talented unmet needs everywhere. So we're not geographically constrained by any means.
Yeah, we've been out pitching since last summer with a pitch deck. We're right there on the front page. said, everything is fintech, and really had this kind of core thesis around how, you know, we'd started to see the very early stages of infrastructure being built that was making it much easier to build financial products. And we kind of saw this analogy to what happened with the early internet, where it was very expensive, very time consuming, all these things to build a company back in the 90s. And largely what you saw was people just kind of taking existing business models and throwing them online, adding a .com to them. But then once we kind of got through that first phase and people started building things like AWS and all these like web programming frameworks, all these different database tools and all this other stuff, like these enabling technologies compounded on each other to the point where today you don't even need to be able to write code to get a company online and like on mobile and all this other stuff. You can just kind of like drag and drop a few things around and you have a company. And we kind of see the same thing playing out in fintech, where the last 10 years of fintech have largely been, let's take everything that we already know and just put it in a mobile app. And there hasn't been any real fundamental disruption in business model. There hasn't been any real fundamental disruption in distribution besides going from offline to online. And there hasn't been any real fundamental disruption in what products are available and who can access them. And so we think that a lot of this enabling technology is going to come down the pipe, compound on itself, and kind of lower the barriers to building financial products, which should inevitably lower the barriers to accessing those financial products. And so that's why we think that, you know, if you're going to change human outcomes, if you're going to have a positive impact on the world, like one of the biggest levers you could possibly pull is financial services. And we want to be there right at the forefront of that and help kind of top entrepreneurs really move the needle on that.
So Chris Skinner and I did an episode on the mobile banks last year. And, you know, our takeaway was most have just, as you eloquently said, Jake, just took what used to be offline. They made it online. They added some functions like the ability to see where you actually, swipe the card or use the payment method. I still don't understand what the utility of that is, because I pretty much remember which Costco I went to and which Starbucks I went to. So that layer of data hasn't helped so much. In both of your crystal balls, where would you say, here's where we think there's a fundamental opportunity to really do business model level implementation or innovation, or to say, hey, by embedding here, it's going to make a really different outcome?
We've kind of long viewed that the opportunity in banking was not so much to like create a better bank UI for millennials, because if there's anybody in the world who is overserved by financial services, it is middle-class millennials in America. Yeah. And so like taking Chase or Wells Fargo or Goldman, Marcus, and just giving it a better UI never seemed particularly compelling to us.
Yeah.
Plus at the end of the day, the business model for a lot of these companies looks almost more like e-commerce than financial services. I mean, you're basically selling somebody else's balance sheet and collecting a thin margin on it. Where we really see the opportunity is we think there's going to be a lot more kind of differentiation and from a product perspective and a lot more defensibility built by actual tech platforms that can either serve businesses or serve consumers with some unique value proposition. And then that's going to depend on who the consumer is or who the business is. But you build software that's targeted towards them and that solves some real pain point for them, and you build a tech platform around that. And then by nature of the fact that you have that distribution, you're built into all those businesses, you're built into all those consumers' lives, you are then able to kind of start to distribute financial products that way, such as offering banking, offering payments, offering lending, offering insurance, stuff like that. And so that's where this whole embedded fintech thing that everybody's raving about now, I think that's what the opportunity is. It's to bring financial services to audiences who would have traditionally been underserved, and doing it by offering them software first, and then finance second, where it kind of tightens the loop on the product and engagement and stuff like that. And that's all very like high level. We could get into some specific examples, but that's the overall thesis.
Well, Shiel, give your thoughts, and then let's get into some specific examples around that both of your theses that I think would be interesting for others to hear and learn from.
Yeah, man, there's a lot there. I think both in, let's call it banking and insurance, I think there are a lot of opportunities for embedded opportunities. Right now it feels like whatever product you go to buy, you then have to finance it and get it insured separately. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it would be a lot easier for the consumer, a lot less friction if it was all done in a seamless manner. So you're starting to have that with Apple. I mean, Apple is obviously a leader in many things, but if you look at what Apple has done with Apple Care and the financing, really like they've basically embedded what used to be different products into the purchase behavior when you buy an iPhone. And I think that same thing is going to happen across a bunch of different products.
And that's a great example where it's not exactly fintech, but the idea, you know, people have a hard time in general, I think, getting their head around what embedded finance is going to look like. It feels like an embedded, you know, pay button, which, you know, isn't all that, you know, interesting or differentiated. But that example of, you know, Apple Care being embedded and the ability to kind of turn it on with the click of a button and how it's delivered, you know, that is a real great example of embedding, you know, what used to be a separate set of products into each other. Do you have other ideas as it relates to fintech where you're looking and you're saying, here's a real example where something should be embedded?
I mean, I guess another example would be Tesla, same sort of deal.
Yeah, so one of my favorite kind of thought experiments around this whole embedded fintech, and naturally we're skewing way off of like access to financial products at this point when we start talking about Tesla owners, but Tesla's in a pretty unique position where you know, they sell their own cars to their own dealerships and they largely operate their own service centers, and like it's a kind of a closed loop, and they have their own warranties and all this other stuff, and now they started selling insurance. And the line between warranties and insurance is kind of arbitrary to an end user. It's important to like whoever's underwriting it behind the scenes, but the end user doesn't really care. And then frankly, car insurance is a commodity product, but at the same time, it's very complicated. There's a bunch of line items in any given car insurance policy that most consumers have no idea what they mean. Like, I spend a lot of time in the insurance space and I still couldn't tell you what like kind of what comprehensive means, right? Like what does that cover that like collision doesn't cover? Or like, why is windshield different from the rest of the car? And like, there's all these different components to go into your auto insurance that most consumers just don't even think about until they have a claim and realize that they're not covered or something. But if you're Tesla and you can start underwriting your own insurance and you're selling your own cars and you have your own dealership networks and like you have this closed loop, I could see a world where you basically like just take insurance out of the equation at some point. So like the insurance just comes with the car and maybe it's priced in as like a subscription payment because you're, you know, if you're leasing the car, you're effectively just subscribing to the car in the first place. So what if Tesla eventually gets to the point where like when you buy the car, they don't ask you for proof of insurance. You just get it from Tesla. The word insurance never comes up. You never have to think about the insurance. You never think about the warranty. You never think about the insurance. It's all just baked into the car. And you subscribe to the car the same way you would subscribe to an iPhone and get Apple Care for free, right? And then when the car breaks, if something happens to it, you take it to Tesla, you drop it off, they hand you a loaner, they load all of your settings onto the loaner because it's all software, and you drive off in basically a new car. And then maybe you go and you swap your car back, or maybe you just keep the new car. I don't know. You know, maybe it's like when you go to the Genius Bar, your phone's broken and they just hand you a new phone because they can't fix what's going on with your phone. Like, there could be a world in the future where like that's Tesla. And then if they really execute on this like fleet idea and, you know, the AV idea, then like maybe you never even owned the Tesla in the first place. You really just subscribe to a car when you need one. And then all these other things that we think about that add all this like mental overhead and cognitive friction for consumers, like picking an auto insurance policy, just gets abstracted away. So you could see stuff like that happening with like lending, insurance and banking, and where everything just kind of gets abstracted away.
Well, and while it's not, you know, sexy blockchain crypto in the cloud with AI, this idea of subscription, you know, models of delivery as opposed to ownership of anything is a fascinating one, right? It happened in software first, and it isn't just about how the software is delivered. It's always having the best available at your fingertips and being able, like you said, to seamlessly, like once you get over this, I think probably very Western ideal around owning something like this is my car, and embrace a business model like that. It has huge ramifications in terms of usage, utilization, costs, you know, that will ripple through. Sheila, other examples you want to build on?
I mean, I'd say like there are countless ones. Like, everything you purchase, a lot of things you purchase have these same characteristics, any major purchase. And I think that's starting to change, and I'm excited for that. And I'm excited for, you know, obviously what that means as an investor in fintech, but also what that means as a consumer. It's still too hard to do these things for people. And I think fintech changes that.
Yeah. Well, in, it's not tech for the sake of tech. You know, the real advantage of fintech, I like to, you know, point to is efficiency, right? I can reach customers that before couldn't afford, you know, one-to-one or AI-driven financial advice, or what Betterment's been able to accomplish in terms of democratizing this idea around having a completely tailored to your risk tolerance and time frame financial plan. I love, there's a Chicago-based company called Halo Invest. I'm not sure if you guys have seen them. They do the same thing for structured products.
Yep.
You know, garner the, you know, $250,000 minimums upfront fees to have access to, you know, things that give you more control over your financial life.
Yeah, I it's really exciting. I mean, so for me, I started my fintech career on the nonprofit side at Kiva, and I was literally like, to serve one borrower, I was like taking a municipal bus and then getting on the back of somebody's motorcycle to like go to a farm to deliver cash. And now, if you think about what's enabled just in a smartphone for these people, it's truly remarkable. And I think, you know, that's obviously an extreme example, but I think the same is true where like the cost of servicing has gone down substantially. That's pretty exciting.
Sorry, I just can't get rid of that image. And we're going to need you to share that on Twitter. The picture of you jumping on the back of somebody's moped, you know, carrying yeah. you know, the little baggie of cash to be delivered.
I have lots of pictures of me also attempting to farm with them, attempting to help them out on the fields. I look like a complete idiot, but
yeah. So along those lines, Jake, how do you think also having, you know, been an early player, not just in fintech, but in financial services, how does this idea of not just being an investor, but being one who has scaled fintech and has come into that from more traditional financial services, how does that impact either your investment thesis or your ability to work with the company afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of my investment thesis, I think so. I didn't like grow up particularly well off, and I'm very acutely aware of a lot of the financial problems that people in the U.S. have. And then Wall Street was just like this bizarro world that I lived in for 6 years, where I just couldn't fundamentally understand the culture and how people could become the way that they were about yeah. money. You know, that's a whole another podcast, but I was itching to get out of Wall Street from just a couple, like after just a couple of years. It took me a while to figure out how, but so that, I mean, my co-founder was kind of in a similar position. And so when we started NerdWallet, the idea was like, screw the banks, screw Wall Street. Like, this world is fundamentally broken, and we need to do something to try to put the power back in the consumer's hand. And then that's largely kind of led into like the types of companies that I like to invest in and the types of opportunities that I'm most interested in as well. Like, I think that there are a lot of people out there that are just fundamentally underserved, and there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the financial system that is intentionally built to hurt the end consumer, or at least like minimize their choice or their own view of what their choices are. So it's always been really interesting to me to try to mitigate that to the extent that I can as one investor. But
so, building on that for a second, and you probably know where I'm going with this, to our shared NerdWallet and Perk Street histories, because we partnered with you so often. Do financial institutions have an obligation to protect customers, particularly the consumers?
A legal obligation?
No, a moral obligation. Like, should it be legal, not just moral, that we're waiting on their best intentions? So should that actually be something they need to do?
I mean, they should. Like, I've long, basically ever since the financial crisis, when I got kind of a front row seat to how broken a lot of the financial plumbing in the world was, I've long felt that breaking up the banks, I mean, obviously there's a lot of nuance to this, and I don't, this isn't a political debate that I want to get into with anybody, so don't at me. But like, I think that breaking up the banks, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of sense to that. Like, there's no reason that commercial banks that hold consumer deposits and what are effectively just dumb pipes, there's no reason why that and an investment bank should be the same thing, and why like you should be able to take consumer deposits and then turn around and invest them in like crazy mortgage structured products. Like, yep. It just is nonsense to me. And it's all just a political fight around regulating and then deregulating and then regulating and deregulating. And then all the consolidation that goes on in the financial system and stuff as people, because benefits tend to accrue to the largest players. Like, they've just tried to get bigger and bigger and bigger. There was just like, none of that seems rational to me. Like, it's just economic rent seeking. And so, I've kind of long felt that there should be at least a form of public utility banking for consumers to make sure that like underserved communities have access to basic financial products. Whereas right now we've kind of regulated our way around it and still made it so that a lot of neighborhoods like can't get a basic bank branch, or a lot of people just can't get a core checking account. And it's just, it's tough. I don't think that's right.
Shiel, what do you think? Is there an obligation on the part of the financial institution that they should make sure that the customers aren't hurting themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's really hard to define what that line is, and also to tell people what is and what is not hurting themselves. And so that's where I really struggle. You know, this has come up recently around accredited investors. Does it make sense that you have to have more than $1 million in net worth to be an investor in a startup or a venture fund or whatever? It seems like an arbitrary thing. Like, you can't invest in a startup. You can invest in Bitcoin or the stock market, or, you know, all sorts of crazy other stuff. So I don't know. I probably, I think it is... It's hard. It's a nuanced topic, and I don't have a fully formed thesis on it. I do think for what we invest in, for like what Better Tomorrow invests in, we are very conscious that we want to invest in stuff that we think is great for all consumers. And we would never invest in something that we think is not at the consumer's best interest. Yeah. So if any of our companies, you know, any company that we looked at, we thought, hey, this is going to make somebody's financial life worse, we're automatically not for it.
Yeah. And Jake, I don't know if I ever had given you this backstory in NerdWallet. This is how Park Street came about. I was working in the student lending industry. And don't get me wrong, you know, a majority of Americans are dependent upon student lending to go to college. But one of my ahas was us, you know, up to a limit, we were very good for their broader financial life, because going to college tends to have a dramatic impact on your earning power. But above a certain threshold, suddenly your debt service far exceeded any utility you were going to go find around it. So our whole thesis behind Perk Street was very much what you just said, Shiel, was, hey, can we structure something like a debit card that has rewards on it as if it were a credit card, that it's good for you and good for us. The more you use the card, but it's the money you have, we make more money. And I'm a little bit surprised that we haven't seen more of that around some of the business models. You know, it's coming into question right now with, you know, Robinhood being investigated and facing, you know, a $10 million fine, but a drop in the bucket, right? But for a long time, it felt like the fintechs had at least claimed a moral high ground as it related to being better for customers. Do you see that and feel that?
Yeah, well, I think there's like a broader topic here, which is that with a lot of financial products and a lot of financial services, like, you can come to market with the idea that you can kind of broaden access and help people in some way, but you can also take it too far. And that's Shiel's point about there being a lot of nuance around what's good for people and what's not good for people. Like, you know, student loans is a good example. The mortgage market is a perfect example. Like, the creation of mortgage-backed securities and the kind of mortgage industry as it exists today was responsible for increasing homeownership in America extensively and dropping the cost of homeownership quite a bit, but then naturally got taken to an extreme,
yep.
And melted down the global economy in 2008. And now we're seeing we're seeing a lot of these extremes continuing to happen. Like Robinhood's a perfect example. Like, sure, let's democratize stock investing and stock ownership for everyday people. But then at the same time, like, what's really happening is you have a bunch of retail traders, like, just day trading options all day.
Yep.
And is that good? Probably not.
I mean especially when you see the data that around day trading actually also becomes this larger gateway into people doing compulsive betting, right? You mm-hmm. know, because it very much too much ease of access allows them to do that behavior in a way that the friction actually kept them from hurting themselves in the past.
Yeah. And there's just a lot of complexity to these things, and I think the financial industry is perfectly attuned to creating things that are highly complex, making them seem really simple, and then selling them to retail. And the mortgages are exactly the same way. Like some of the structures they came up with to get people to buy homes that they couldn't actually afford were incredibly creative, but also incredibly destructive. I mean, I worked on a desk where we traded mortgage-backed securities, and one of the traders came in one day with a pitch from, I think it was like, his brother-in-law or something was trying to buy a home, and a mortgage broker was trying to sell him this like crazy complex mortgage. And even the trader on our desk who traded mortgage-backed securities and was an interest rate specialist had no idea what this mortgage was trying to accomplish. And then you have brokers out there selling those to retail, and that's dangerous. And so the same thing can happen in any financial product. I think the only thing that you can't really do that with is like a checking account with a debit card attached to it. There's some things where it's just simple. It works. Like, people need it.
This point of, you know, when taken to extremes, you know, bad things tend to happen. And if we look at fintech right now, it really does feel like, with the amount of venture money pouring into fintech, does it feel like we're in one of those like outer portions of the pendulum swing right now? Sheil?
It certainly feels that way. Yeah. it certainly feels that way to us. You know, there's been obviously a ton of success in fintech this year in terms of exits. Obviously a huge lagging indicator, but Credit Karma, Plaid, the Bill.com IPO, you know, all these things has led a ton of non-fintech investors to want to make fintech investments.
Yep.
And it's getting pretty crazy right now. I'd say we're seeing a lot of folks who don't understand the space very well come in and definitely bidding up prices. And that's been honestly a challenge for us to a certain extent. It hasn't really impacted us yet, but I could see that happening. And I'm worried about how this all ends. And hopefully the way it ends is there becomes some other hot sector that these same people go after next. Leaving us alone.
So with the gold rush coming in, you know, the fintech's hot, and you've just described, you know, hopefully there will be another phase when it's not. What's been your experience investing with non-fintech experts? You know, this either the so-called generalists or the ones that are just following momentum into the space. How does that impact, you know, especially as an early investor, those a lot of times are the ones willing to pay up into a future round. You know, how do you convince a founder that it might not be in their best interest to maximize valuation?
Yeah, so we've had pretty good luck with this. I think we feel like we have a differentiated and compelling story. And what we tell people is, at the seed stage, which happens to be where we invest, you want to take money from people who provide you the most value, most support. And what is support? It's like industry experience that gives you credibility, yep. Operational know-how, founder empathy, and a signal to future investors. And those are the things that are important at the seed stage. At Series A stage, the thing that's most important is getting a big brand, or not the most important, but one of the most important things. Yep. And the reason that it, for that is a brand sends a signal to customers and employees and that sort of stuff. And then B and beyond, you get the best terms you can get. There are times where we've come up against other big firms wanting to come down into the seed stage. And I think it happened a lot, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic. I think the later stage funds said, hey, we don't feel comfortable writing a $10 to $15 million check without meeting a founder first, but we do feel comfortable writing a, what I'll call a lead gen check of a couple million bucks. And they don't really care what the valuation is because it doesn't really matter option. To them. They're buying an option. And, you know, what a lot of founders have said is that they don't, well, actually, like we have an example of this in our own portfolio, a company that we did the pre-seed of, unnamed, very large, well-known firm did the seed of. And literally, you know, a year later, the guy who did this seed round couldn't tell you what the company did. Like, I had a conversation with him on stage about our shared company, and he really stumbled what the company did. And that's not the kind of investor we are. Like, we're in the weeds with our companies every, you know, every day we're talking to our portfolio yep. companies. And so if that's what you need and what you want, which I think for most founders it is, then come to folks like us. And then in terms of where that ends up on valuation, you know, I think some people are stuck on a valuation number. What ends up or what I'd say is a round size. And what they don't realize is typically a larger round size typically ends up as more dilution too. It's not like mm-hmm. they're in lockstep with valuation. They're not. And so you taking more money from a later stage fund often means you've also taken more dilution than you had to at a particular round.
Jake, any parting shots related to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing that Sheila and I hear on pitches with founders, especially like, you know, financial services covers so much ground. And a lot of these companies you talk to kind of really get into the weeds in different aspects of the financial system that like an average person off the street just can't be expected to know anything about or understand. And that goes for the investor class as well. And there's so many times when Sheila and I are on a pitch with a company and the founder is like, I can't tell you how refreshing it is that I didn't have to spend the first half hour of this call explaining insurance to you.
Yeah.
Or like teaching you what reinsurance is, or like teaching you the ins and outs of securitization and stuff like that. Like, just the fact that we can come to these meetings prepared and already knowing what the business model of the company is, no matter yeah. kind of how wonky it gets, I think really, really resonates.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Thanks for taking the time out, both of you. Know you're particularly busy, even in lockdown. So look forward to seeing more great things out of BTV, especially, you know, pursuing a stage with a level of expertise that we don't see a lot of people playing in.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
Hey, Charles, it's been a while. Big congrats on your recent investment. You're in London right now, yeah?
Yeah, well, yes, I'm in lockdown in London, but yes.
You're in lockdown. Because I know you've been based going between Australia and London for a while, but how has that affected you during COVID? Because I know I haven't been able to get to Australia myself.
Yeah, I haven't been out together at all. I mean, the country's shut down. I haven't been there for almost a year now. It's been pretty dramatic.
And London's faring okay right now, right, with COVID?
sort of okay, yeah. Depends on, I'm not going to get into a political diatribe now. Depends on your view. Probably could have done better. But yeah, it's kind of okay.
All right. Well, look, you know, I know we've had you on the show a few times before, but let's jump into it. I did note that you guys, you know, and for the first time, I assume, you know, apart from your own funding that you're able to organically grow the business with, you've taken in, you know, a sizable investment recently. What made you decide to seek investment and why from the US specifically?
Well, we actually thought it was a great time. I mean, as you know, we're a data-driven insights business, and we started just before the last financial crisis back in 2008. So our goal has always been to provide data to our clients, to financial institutions, on how customers are behaving and how that behavior is changing, and particularly in trying times like these. And we've been growing probably for the last 14 years, about 30% year on year. And then in sort of March, we had, you know, a record month, and our numbers really started to move. So luckily for us, our data-driven business model has prospered. And therefore, we wanted to take advantage of that growth. And, you know, we've got all this data we've been gathering for 14 years across the whole remit of financial services and geographically. And we really wanted to get, you know, a top technology partner to help us take all that data, right, to enable our clients to access it. Because one of the things that's happened with globalization, as you know, is everything, it used to be sort of a domino effect of something would happen in a market, and then 3 or 6 months later it would happen in another market, and gradually it would make its way through different markets around the world. Whereas now things happen instantly. So, you know, as soon as something's happening in Singapore or Canada or Mexico or the UK or Germany, wherever it might be, you know, whether it's open banking, whether it's buy now, pay later, whether it's access to data, whether it's fintechs partnering with banks, all these things are happening in different markets in sort of simultaneous real time. So that ability to take the customer data and show the impact and best practice and sort of move it across those learnings across to other markets in sort of instant real time is key. And that's why we wanted to get a technology partner from the US.
So do you think that COVID has really, I mean, given the revenue spike that you had this year, do you think that's because more and more banks are finally saying, well, heck, we need to know the areas we need to ramp up digitally because behaviors changed pretty radically during COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, we provide data. Data is, you know, we kind of think of it as the oil that lubricates financial services. But what we've seen as the impact of COVID is really a mass acceleration. So, you know, any bank that was sort of sitting on the sidelines, and there were a few in some markets thinking, yeah, how much should we invest in digital? Is this really something that's, you know, that's across all generations? You know, does this really appear to our traditional customer base? Even those banks have had to move really quickly. And that's playing itself out in so many different ways in all the data that we're seeing right now.
When you look at that data, we've seen a lot of noise about challenger banks this year, a lot of people talking about profitability of challengers and so forth, but the fintechs as well, you mentioned buy now, pay later. So, you know, are the fintechs taking market share now? Can we actually see that from the data?
So they have the opportunity to cause a shift in market share, I think is a better way of looking at it. You know, banks have security. You know, all customers, be it businesses or consumers, you know, the number one thing they want is trust in financial services, and they define that as keep my money safe and secure and my private information private. But with the rapid rise of fintechs, I mean, fintechs, you know, they get rid of the friction points. You know, it's ease, it's speed, it's convenience, it saves money, and that combination, any partnership, you know, like yourself with, you know, with Moovin and TD, that combination can be very, very powerful. And just, you know, on the business side, you know, businesses that are using fintechs to do their international transfers are twice as likely as other businesses to shift their entire banking relationship. So yeah, the fintech's not actually taking market share, but it's causing a significant shift in market share at the same time with, you know, with what it provides.
Now, there's a lot of debate around Affirm and Klarna and the buy now, pay later stuff. You've been watching this for a few years in terms of trending. So, you know, it seems to me that this is the big year for these guys where they're sort of really creeping in on credit card sort of 12 months interest free deals, you know, replacing that. Do you see this as a sustained sustainable business, the buy now, pay later stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you've seen CBN and NAB in Australia with their zero interest credit card offerings that they've had to bring out in reaction to this. But looking at Australia, which is one of the most evolved markets for buy now pay later, over the last 3 years, looking at our data, the area that or the segment that's grown most in both its usage and its sticky usage of buy now pay later is Generation X. It's not the millennials. Yeah. It's not the millennials who can't get access to credit. It's Generation X who can get access to credit who just prefer the buy now pay later experience. So I think that kind of indicates that it's going to be here. It's growing hugely in the US, Canada, the UK, France, all over the place. I think it's going to be here. I think it's going to be one of the winning models coming out of the pandemic.
Awesome. Well, you know, look, there's a ton more stuff that we could talk about. It's great to see you, man. But
Always great to chat to you, Brett. Thank you.
So, just quickly, how can people find out more about about RFI and this shift that you've or the investment you've taken?
Yeah, just go to our website, rfigroup.com, everything that we offer is there and everything that we're going to be offering over the next couple of years as we build out all these exciting new capabilities across these new markets, and get in contact with us that way. That'd be great.
Great. Charles Green, Charlie, thanks again for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Always good to chat, Brett. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.